to the fourth case today, Navarro versus FDIC.
Please the court, your honors, counsel. My name is Tony Capua. I represent the appellant. The issue in this case, your honors, is whether Mrs. Navarro, the appellant, is entitled to her severance payments under the deferred compensation agreements from the appellee, FDIC. Mrs. Navarro started working at a Universal Savings Bank in 1963 as a part-time file clerk. And over the next 39 years, had worked her way up to president of that bank. The subjects of this suit are two agreements that Mrs. Navarro entered into with Universal Bank, which were styled Deferred Compensation and Salary Continuance Agreements. One was in 1981, the other in 1987. Unfortunately, on June 27, 2002, the Office of Thrift Supervision appointed FDIC as receiver of Universal. And in August, Navarro made claims under both of those agreements, the 1981 and the 1987 agreements. The FDIC rejected those claims for a variety of reasons, some of which they have now abandoned, but what stands now is they're rejecting the claims because purportedly there are conditions precedent in those agreements that were not met. We can see that Mrs. Navarro's termination is governed by 12 CFR 563, which states that an employment contract does terminate as of the date of default, except that the termination does not affect any vested rights of the employee. We contend that Mrs. Navarro's rights had vested as of the date of termination. First, these agreements are in the nature of deferred compensation, meaning that Navarro had already worked and earned this money. They were not the kind of severance packages where it's prospective or you get something for not working. The 1981 agreement states that if Navarro dies, her estate gets the full amount of the agreement, $50,000. If she retires at age 65, she gets the full amount, $50,000. If she is terminated voluntarily or involuntarily for reasons other than death or retirement, she is paid according to a fixed schedule based on how many years she had worked at the bank. Thus, after her employment terminated as a result of the receivership, the only thing Navarro had to do was make a claim, which she did.
This receivership didn't just come out of the blue, though, correct?
Judge, there were things that happened prior to the receivership which caused it, sure.
Yeah, I don't know what the FDIC is going to say about this, but it seems that they're at least admitting that if she had quit a day before, on June 26th, she'd be entitled to this money.
Judge, that is where the absurdity comes in. First of all, the day before is just an arbitrary. If the question is before, it could have been 1 second before. Mm-hmm. If the person from OTS would have walked through the door, she could have run up to him and said, wait a minute, before you say anything, I quit. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you have to say? And there would be no problem. That's the absurdity that you face if you contend that Navarro had to take some positive action to terminate her employment. Well,
perhaps the FDIC will discuss that absurdity, which I certainly agree with you.
The other absurd aspect of this, and when it is a tenet, and I believe the court, I'm not informing the court of this, but it's a tenet of contract construction, that if there is an ambiguity or a question, these contracts must be interpreted in a way to avoid an absurd result. In the case of the 1981 agreement, it specifically states that if Navarro terminates her employment voluntarily or involuntarily, that she's entitled to what she had earned. The FDIC's position is, well, she didn't do anything positive to involuntarily terminate her own employment. When you start thinking about that, how does one do that? By definition, involuntary means it's done to you. it's something out of your control. I don't see how you can do something positive to involuntarily quit. It just, you run into a block of illogic there.
In addition to your position that we could interpret that provision in the way you would like us to interpret, I mean, the fact that it's ambiguous, normally we construe that then in favor of, against the drafter.
Well, it's not part of the record as it now stands, because this case is before you on a very abridged discovery. In fact, I believe this is a converted 12b-6. So on that basis, it would be appropriate to remand. However, I can tell you that Navarro did not draft this agreement.
Oh, yeah, I know she did. I mean, she's the beneficiary. I mean, if we...
Correct. The other aspect of the agreement is it's fixed. You can pick any date from February of 1981 through today and tell to the penny how much Navarro is due. The more reasonable interpretation, whether or not there existed a condition precedent, is to say, if you have this kind of schedule where an employee accrues so much benefit after a certain period of time and the employee is working, passing those milestones, and the only thing left to do is for the employee to claim the money, then that is a vested benefit, one that is specifically exempted by the statute. Navarro is not seeking any prospective benefits. She's only seeking the retrospective benefits. Now, the FDIC is saying, well, the contract states if Navarro must, if the employee terminates her employment, and she didn't do that, it was terminated by operation of the law. All that means, Your Honors, and this phrase by operation of the law is one of those tricky phrases that pops up in opinions every now and then and really doesn't causes nothing but trouble for litigants and lawyers and probably judges. If they mean that Navarro's termination was governed by 12 CSR 563.39, fine, let's say that. But that doesn't mean that all condition precedents were vitiated, since that regulation itself comprehends exempting vested benefits. We urge this court to reverse the decision and remand the matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gunning?
May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Gunning. I represent the FDIC. With me at counsel table is co-counsel Charles Albert. Counsel for Navarro correctly stated the one issue here is were her severance payments vested prior to the termination of the receivership. Unfortunately, when you have a receivership, the whole landscape changes and you have adverse results for everybody involved in the receivership. Even for those people, the reg in question was aimed at people who had two lucrative contracts to help the regulators preclude that from taking away money from the receivership.
You agree that if she had said, I quit, walked out the door on the 26th, she would be entitled to this deferred compensation?
That's correct, Your Honor, because that is the language that she agreed to in the agreement. It says if she terminates for reasons other than retirement or death, she gets her payment. The schedule of payments is not deferred compensation, but it's a way of judging how much severance she's going to get. In the contextual part of each section of the 81 and the 87 agreement, it talks about severance payments, which would be payments upon termination of her work.
You know, sometimes we make an effort to have common sense coincide with the law. Does it make any sense here to say that this person who worked 40-some years has deferred compensation coming? she stood up and said, I quit on June 26th. She gets it. But she came to work the next day on the 27th. FDIC took over. She doesn't get it. But where is the sense of logic or fairness and stuff?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a nice result in terms of what you'd like to do to help people out. But as receivers, as the fiduciaries, we have to read and interpret the contracts we have as written. And this contract that she agreed to said that she was required to terminate. There are a number of contingencies that could have happened that would have precluded her because she remained employed and she didn't terminate. There could have been death, retirement, or termination by the bank, or termination for cause or by the bank for cause or not cause. So that there was all sorts of contingencies that could have happened that would have precluded her from getting.
What about this term that she can involuntarily terminate herself? I mean, isn't that ambiguous?
Your Honor, we have examples of when we think there can be an employee can involuntarily terminate themselves in our brief, including constructive discharge.
But with respect to constructive discharge, isn't that, as a matter of law, still an employer's act and not that of an employee? When you look at Title VII law?
Yes, Your Honor, but the employee is the one who quit. So that is a way to involuntarily quit.
But I'm saying, isn't that the employee? It's the employer's act that causes the employee to quit.
Yes. There are other situations we gave in terms of being disabled or whatever, where she doesn't want to quit. She wants to work, but she does come in and does quit. But even if you were to give the interpretation that Navarro wants to give, that it means if you terminate for any reason, and if I understand her argument, even termination by receivership, then even under that interpretation, she does not win. Under the regulation, the right must have vested prior to the receivership. If you read the Malusi case that they're relying on, they provide that the receivership itself cannot be the vesting event at the same time as voiding. Mr. Mezhulewski tried to argue that even though he hadn't reached retirement age, there was a change of control, and under change of control situations, he gets his full benefit. And that court said, no, you don't get your full benefits because you cannot have the voiding event of the contract also be the vesting event. In Modlewski case, they had a bright line test of the retirement age. And I think in those particular cases where there is retirement age, where you can reach that one particular age, courts have found that that would be a vesting event. Even in
you don't control when you become 60 or 65, but you control when you're going to stop working. Or some, she had this entirely within her control. The FDIC would have said, we're going to take over this place tomorrow or in 3 hours. She could have taken effective action to protect her deferred compensation.
That's right, Your Honor, and she didn't.
But you never gave her an opportunity to do that, did you?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, of whether she had knowledge that a receivership was coming. But
well, okay. I'm assuming that it didn't come out of the blue, that everybody knows that something was going to happen. But I'm talking about the FDIC giving notice an hour before, a day before.
They don't give notice before closing, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
The OTS closes. They don't give,
the OTS does the closing and then the FDIC comes in next.
As receiver, right.
But nobody gives any notice that it's going to happen so that people have invested rights and or people can take a step that will secure the vesting of their rights. That just doesn't seem fair to me.
Well, unfortunately, as I said, in receivership, Your Honor.
It doesn't seem very, very fair.
Unfortunately, in receivership, there's a lot of results that are not advantageous to the parties, to our unsecured creditors, and even to some of our depositors. But that is the contract that she signed, and that's the correct interpretation of it.
Well, the contract didn't envision receivership, obviously.
No, Your Honor, but the regulation provides that it's written into the contract so that that the regulation that says that the contract would
can you keep your voice up?
I'm sorry, that the contract would become void upon receivership was essentially read as a part of the contract. Because we believe that the district court correctly found that there was not vesting in this case, we request that you affirm below.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. CSR 563.39 was not meant to penalize the workers of these institutions that were closed. It was meant in section B4 to alleviate the very adverse conditions that council spoke of. It was meant to protect the rights, not take them away. One thing I failed to mention is there's also language in that contract, quite apart from, it's in the same clause as the language that says if employee terminates employment. It says the benefits following, and then there's the schedule, following the discontinuance of employment are payable prior to retirement. Discontinuance of employment doesn't imply any positive action on the part of Navarro. She's discontinued. She's done it.
You know, I seem to remember, maybe I'm wrong on this, but that there's some provisions that permit in the taking over of a loan institution the repudiation of contract.
The contracts, Your Honor, terminate. 563.39 terminates employment contracts. Future obligations. Not past vested obligation.
Okay.
Yes. Constructive discharge and having mental problems and things like that, it's still a voluntary decision to leave. And so, you know, you might have to hold your nose or you might say it stinks, but you're still deciding to leave.
Let me ask you this. The benefits here are fairly modest, I think. What if you have a situation where the benefits are really, I mean, for some reason, millions and millions of dollars? Then what would the FDIC do, or what should they do?
Well,
to protect itself from getting stuck honoring something that would never have been honored because the institution is going under anyhow.
The FDIC has the protection of certain golden parachute statutes, and as a matter of fact, that was their original reason for denying the benefit. Since then, it has been withdrawn or has not been brought up, at least. But those statutes provide adequate protection in the form of excise taxes and things like that. As this case goes, right, the benefits are a little over just $100,000, and that's for 40 years' work. So this is not a golden parachute situation.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thanks to counsel on both sides. We'll move to case number 5.